All right. Shall I just let you just keep asking questions till we're done? Or shall I try to take control of the situation? Linda raised a point during the break in relation to your question to Tamisha? Tushima. About the past, because she was pointing out that when your consciousness begins to expand, you get a very different perspective on the past. So even though the events might not change, you actually understand them very differently. You may begin to see what the lesson was that you were supposed to have gained from it. You may understand perhaps somebody's good intentions that you misread. You may understand your own errors in the past. So even though circumstances don't change, it looks, I mean, because it looks completely different too if you're looking at it like this, compared to when you're looking at it like this. So the whole question of how fixed reality is, it's like it looks a different way depending on the angle that you're looking at it. So it's constantly changing. In fact, the past is constantly changing because when you look at it here, it looks differently than you look at it here. I just was on an airplane. I was on the ground. When I flew out of Puerto Vallarta, the airport is right at the edge of the bay. So I'd been looking toward, and I'd been watching the planes go. And all of a sudden, I'm in a plane and I'm looking back at the beach. You know, everything is exactly the same, but it's all shifting because my perspective is shifting. And I get higher and higher, and I saw where we'd been staying in relation to buildings around. I mean, just everything was different, but nothing had really changed. But my point of view on it had completely changed. And once you get down to consciousness, when your consciousness changes, everything changes. And ultimately, the end of finding happiness is the only thing you ever have any actual influence over is your response and how you experience it. But of course, when your response and how you experience changes, then that has an enormous effect on everything also. I mean, we were talking about mothers and their children. Everybody who's tried to raise children knows that those children are amazingly tuned into your reality. And when your reality changes, their reality changes. And what the only thing that's really shifted is the vibrations that you're putting out. And it all comes down to this, interestingly, to this chart. The closer you are to the heart of eternity, the way you relate to the dream is different. So does that mean the dream changes? The past changes? It's a little hard to say, isn't it? Because it might as well have changed because your experience of it is so different. This is speaking of the really challenging aspects of karma. There is this man, his name is Richard Wurmbrand. I presume he's off the planet now because he was elderly when I met him decades ago. He was a Jew, a Romanian Jew who converted to Christianity. So as a Jew in Romania, he got to be persecuted by the Nazis. And then when he became a Christian, he got to be persecuted by the communists. So he went through the kind of experiences that are nightmares to the rest of us. Concentration camps, prison. And he wrote a book. He wrote several. He wrote a book called Tortured for Christ. I mean, and it really is. It's just an amazing, awful story of his ability to hold the power and the presence of God against the most challenging circumstances that the human imagination can conjure. And I met this man. We all knew about him because his books were so inspiring. And when I was living at Ananda Village back in the 70s, he came to speak at a local church. He was a very fundamentalist Christian. His theology on paper was very narrow, but his actual experience was infinite. And he came to speak, and a whole bunch of us went to speak. And actually, just the irony of it was at one of the local churches, and they had a setup there where there was kind of an arch. And a speaker could stand there and he could look into two rooms. There was one room on either side of the arch. And so on one side was the congregation of that church, and there were so many of us that we were almost entirely the other side. So he would literally address them for a while, and then he would turn and address us for a while. What he said to us was really different than what he said to them. You know, with us, it was the power of Christ and the formless Christ, the inner experience, the freedom of it. To them, it was, you know, he died for our sins, sort of. It was just, it was amazing. And there was another man who had also been through similar experiences. That man was shriveled and broken physically, mentally. He was just an enfeebled person. And they introduced him also. And he had been through the same experience as Wormbrand was. Powerful and radiant and filled with joy and filled with love. Just overwhelmingly wonderful. This man was, you could see, you know, and they were respecting him because of what he'd endured for his faith, but completely different way they had taken the same experiences. Because in the end, that's what it is. There was a story. I mean, these are the most horrific examples. There was a story about a man who was captured in Vietnam during that era, and he was also tortured. And he was pretty much at the end of his ability to endure, and he was literally being tortured in that moment. And he reached a level of surrender to God that was beyond anything that he even knew was possible, because until that time he'd been trying to hold it together with his own will, and he simply couldn't, and he just let go of that and merged into the infinite. And he said in that moment, he said this, the power and the presence of God was overwhelming, and the sense of love was overwhelming, and all antagonism, any sense of that this is unfair, or that anybody's doing anything to me, just left him like that. And the man who was torturing him literally just looked at him like this, and he radiated so much love to him that the man walked out and no one ever touched him again for the rest of the time he was there. And he said, you know, was it worth it? Of course it was worth it, because it just brought him to something he never would have come to otherwise. So bad is not necessarily bad. It's unpleasant. Unpleasant and difficult is not the same as bad. And if karma is always fair, which, you know, is an interesting question, but I believe it's so. If God is really in charge, if Divine Mother really loves us and is really helping us, then in the midst of whatever it is, there is the potential for blessing. Whether we take that blessing or not is the challenge. And you were asking me, how do we move gracefully into this? To my mind, I mean, there are certain things to me that are key. One is, we are part of a greater reality. And I comfortably talk about God, I talk about Guru, I talk about Divine Mother. I have many ways of talking about it. It doesn't really matter how you talk about it. We are part of a greater reality. That greater reality loves us. It's an active, loving force. And that loving force is always looking out for our best interests. And just like a good mother, that's where the idea of Divine Mother really helps. You know, oftentimes, your kid does not like what you're doing. You know, you take your child to kindergarten, and the child says, Mommy, Mommy, why do I have to go to school? Well, you can't live with me forever. Yes, I can. Yes, I can. You know, you need to learn to read. No, I don't. No, I don't. I mean, that's the absolute wisdom of a child. Right? Give me the whole cake for breakfast, Mommy. You won't grow up strong. Yes, I will. I mean, we're just about that smart with Divine Mother. Give me this terrible situation. I really want it. Divine Mother says, no, it's bad for you. We say, no, it's not. It's really good for me. I know. And we don't. So she doesn't. So we are part of this greater reality. That greater reality is wise and loving. And the other part of this is, the story has a happy ending. And if we haven't reached the happy ending, we are not at the end of the story. And that's really helpful, because in the middle of the story, if there's no happy ending, we think it's over. Because somebody has died. Somebody seems to be irretrievably lost in some way or another. And the fact of the matter is, they may be. You see, this is not, everything is just fine and happens the way it's supposed to happen. It may happen the way it's supposed to happen, but it's often not fine at all. But it's not the end of the story. So if we haven't reached the happy ending, we're not at the end of the story. We're just still in the exciting middle in which the hero falls into the pit and we don't know whether he's going to come out or not. You know, I mean, that's a really exciting part of the story, unless it's you. But if you can get there, we are part of a greater reality. That reality is wise and loves us. The story has a happy ending. Okay. And everything that happens to me is necessary for me to learn something I don't know. And it's never unfair. That doesn't mean people are behaving well, because God is very skillful in finding just the right awful person to execute the lesson that you need. There's a fabulous story, and this is apparently a true story. In Bangkok, there's the Golden Buddha. It's this beautiful Buddha that's all made out of gold, and everybody goes and makes their prayers there. And we went to Thailand a couple of times on our way to and from India, and it's really wonderful. And this is the story that was told to us about this Golden Buddha. It's very ancient. Nobody knows how old it is, but this is its history. At a certain point, Thailand was, the Golden Buddha had a place of honor in some king's place, and they were being invaded by barbarians. And they were afraid they would lose, so they took the Golden Buddha, they covered it with plaster, and they took it from its place of honor, and they just set it by the side of a river. So it just looked like a plaster statue sitting by the side of a river of no particular value. There were lots of statues all over the place. So the barbarians came, and they took the place, and they ruled for a period of time, and that statue just sat out there. And it sat out there for quite a long time. And everybody who remembered why it was there forgot, because that whole regime was gone. So some centuries went by, and then somebody had the idea that it was a very nice statue, and maybe it should be given a place of honor. So they decided they would move it. And it was very heavy, and it was very difficult to move, but somebody was willing to move it, so they got a cart, and they sort of started moving this thing in. And at a certain point, it was too heavy for the cart. The cart began to totter, and the cart falls over. The statue hits the ground, the plaster breaks off, and they realize it's gold inside. So this is how they find out. Now, my part, what I love about this story, first of all, there's some engineer who had the chutzpah to say, I can move the statue, right? Mm-hmm. You can imagine him lying awake at night before they moved the statue, saying to his wife, I hope it works, I hope it works, you know? He had the courage to try, but he wasn't quite competent enough to succeed, right? So God had to find someone who had both of those qualities. If he'd found an engineer who was competent enough to move it, they never would have discovered what was inside, right? And then there's the moment where he's watching all his hard work just go like this. You know, all his calculations are wrong and the thing falls over, right? And so this is the hero's falling into the pit. The king's going to cut my head off, whatever the jeopardy was, there it's going. But then then after it smashes, he realizes, oh, we were going somewhere that I never knew where we were going, right? So if we know that we are part of a greater reality, that there is a wise and loving mother who's in charge, and if we haven't reached the happy ending, we're not at the end of the story, that this just has to happen because this is the only way the plot can unfold. You see how differently you would respond to everything in your life, because you realize that the only thing I'm ever experiencing is the energy with which I respond. Do I respond, oh no, here it comes again, and it's always happening to me, and no matter how hard I try, and then, you know, like that, or to our children we say, I've sacrificed everything and this is the way you repay me. Just go ahead, don't think about me, you know. Like, that's not going to work. Do we say that my husband, who's a smart man for 25 years, had told me not to put the luggage on the hood of the car? Oh, I'll put it on the hood of the car, like that. No, surprise, surprise. You know, it's like, how do we respond to everything? And what is God trying to teach me? And when it involves other people, how can I serve? We think that everything is there to make our lives pleasant and easy. And nothing is there to make our lives pleasant and easy, because what would we gain at the end of it? Where would we be at the end of it if everything is pleasant and easy? We were born, we live, we hang around for a while, we get older and older, And, you know, I'm old enough to have gotten older and older and just noticing how, wow, it's really different than it was when I was 20. Everything is different. Like, what do I have? And death will come. Death has taken a great many friends, taken Swami Kriyananda off the planet, people that were vitally important there. Nothing lasts. You know, it's just, and when that happens, what do I say? Why? Or do I say, oh, this is to fix my consciousness. This is to teach me something I don't already know. And let me get busy and learn it. And then, you know, happiness becomes happy. The whole definition of happiness, you see, is different. It's not pleasure and ease. The definition of happiness is getting on with the main story. And that main story is to move ourselves closer to the center of eternity and to see it all as our Divine Mother sees it. It's wonderful. I mean, the images of children are so, everything in this world is a symbol. The way you watch children grow up, and if you have any involvement or understanding of how children are raised, just be that child yourself and see yourself from that perspective. With living as and knowing Swami Kriyananda as I did for so long, and his perspective was so expansive, and he was such an extraordinary example of wise and loving divinity. Just always helping us, and sometimes I think, oh my gosh, you know, what we look like to him, just children playing in the mud, so serious about our little mud pies and so serious about our little commitment. I'll give you a specific example. When I was 22 and he was, I think, 43 or 44 when I met him, 43. So there was, you know, obviously, there was always a 20, 21-year gap between us. But when I was in my 20s and he was in his 40s, I was really just young and excited and enthusiastic. And I had many good qualities, but I had other qualities as well, and lots of them. And I was an asset overall, but I was also a trial, a real trial. And when I got to be 44 and I was working with people who were the same age as me, as I had been when I started, you know, it was really tempting sometimes to say things like, you're just a child, what do you know? You know, or just being annoyed and just wanting to use my authority to suppress their energy so they would just go away and not be so 20, you know. But I appreciated that I was looking in the mirror, you know, because I have a pretty good memory and I can specifically, you know, chronicle the incidences. It's not like I know what I did. Anyway, moving right along, I realized that in all the years I had known Swamiji, he had never, and I mean this, he had never referred to my lack of experience or my age. Not once. And I mean, it was like a neon sign I was wearing, but he never said it. And so I saw him after this sort of revelation came to me, and I said, Swamiji, I really want to thank you. And I said, you know, I realize you never, in all that time, even though my immaturity was so self-evident, you never referred to it. So he accepted that graciously, but he had a look on his face that I knew that the conversation wasn't finished. And then after he accepted what I said, because it was appropriate for me to express appreciation, so he accepted it. But then he said, I never noticed. That was what he said. He said, I never see anybody's age. He said, that's just a factor of the body. The soul is ageless. He said, I don't look at people. He said, I look into them. I look into their eyes. And so he never defined me as I defined myself. He defined me as the jiva on its way to soul freedom. And, you know, I was young now. He was older. He'd been young when I was older. I mean, it just, what difference did it make? And I realized in that so many important things that, yes, it's good to affirm the right attitude. And it's a good idea to discipline your consciousness to behave rightly according to what you know is the ideal. But that is not the end point. That what we really need to do is we need to change our consciousness so we are perceiving reality from a higher level. From the point of view of the eternal now, 22, 41, 108, 2. I mean, like, what difference does it make? When Swami was a baby, he was going into super consciousness. When he couldn't talk about it, because he didn't have language yet, but that his consciousness was exactly the same. That's why when he came in through Kriya as an adult, he just came to exactly where he'd always been, to perceive that and behave accordingly. That's the real change of consciousness. And then it's not suppression, it's not discipline, it's not willpower. It's just spontaneous perception. And that's where real happiness comes from. It's better to behave right out of willpower. Ed Master himself puts it this way in one of his poems. He says, it's not enough to be good merely because it's your habit to be good. He said, you need to be good because it's your spontaneous perception of the world. I've had fun with it over years because I have a very critical mind or an analytical mind, and I used to have a very sharp tongue, and I would say the truth in ways that were not always helpful. And I, realizing that wasn't a good idea, I've gradually tried to change my way of responding. And every so often I'm so pleased because I'll say the truth, but I'll just say it in a helpful way. And it comes out of my mouth like that. It's true. But it's just like, oh yes, he does have a very original way of expressing himself, doesn't he? You know, that's saying he's going to be so obnoxious, can't he? I mean, it would just be what I would have said before. Like, who in his right mind would have responded like that? But instead, I say, oh, he has a very original way of responding. And I really mean it. Because first you discipline yourself, then you affirm the right attitude, but then gradually you begin to realize, oh yeah, this is just the way people are. And I want to serve them. I don't want to just serve myself. And how helpful is it to be telling everybody what a turkey they are, really? When, you know, I'm very willing to help people, and I try to say yes of whatever I'm asked. And I tell people, don't worry, you can't impose on me, because if I don't want to do it, believe me, I'll say I won't. And whenever I'm trying to serve people and the thought crosses my mind, if you weren't such a jerk, you wouldn't be doing this. I think, wait, take a break, you know. It's just like my consciousness is off. And it's just not a question of their behavior. It's that my consciousness is off. And if I can just pull back into myself, get closer to my infinite nature, then I can look at exactly the same situation. And yes, of course, but they're learning what they have to learn. If it's not the happy ending, it's not the end of the story. And that's where Swami can just say, oh, I never noticed. But he remembered many years later. He used the phrase something about he would have made this change years ago, except Asha always opposed me, thwarted me, always thwarted me. That was his word. Oops. And I remember distinctly that I did thwart him. And then I said, I thwarted you quite a lot, didn't I? He just said, yes. You know, just because I, ignorant as I was, it didn't stop me from expressing my point of view. And he was respectful and didn't want to directly contradict me. So I gave him a global apology, and he accepted it because it was owed. But at the time, he wanted to serve me, and it wouldn't have served me to have suppressed my energy. Because overall, you know, I was worth it. It was like the good was going to outrun the bad in the end, so he worked on it. But you see, that's real service. When intentions that he knew were good intentions, he would still think in terms of all the people. And I'm just one, you know. I'm just one. There were literally thousands of us. Does that make sense? These are very high ideals. But I don't see any reason to mince words. You can take shortcuts and, you know, patch the dam a little bit and it'll hold for a while, but it's just going to spring a leak somewhere else. You know, you really need to just go to the foundation here and look for what we're really looking for. Okay, questions, thoughts? My goodness, have you dried up? I shouldn't have given you a break. Yes.
My question was been about just expanding a little bit on relationships.
Sure.
So if I want to serve in a relationship, I allow that person to do their own.
No, not necessarily. The key word in relationship is you have to respond appropriately. Because if somebody is doing something that's entirely inappropriate, for you to give them the impression that that's just fine is in no way serving them. Now, you can respond at different levels. You know, if someone is inappropriate and you're furious about it, it's still better for you to stop their energy. Ideally, you can be calmly centered, absolutely firm, and still stop their energy, but it's better to stop their energy. You hit the highest level that you can hit. Because, see, people make a grave mistake and they think that to serve people means that you're nice. Not necessarily. I mean, think about the mother. I literally knew a woman who didn't like to hear her children cry, and she raised the most helpless, spoiled children. They were just impossible. They couldn't function in the world because she never wanted them to cry. That's not love. That's absolute cowardice. You know, you have to behave appropriately. And you do it with as pure a heart as you can, but you still have to do it because sometimes it's your own fear. And for you also, you see, appropriate includes you. This is what people sometimes don't understand. You're as important as everybody else. You're neither more important, but you're not less important. You have to simply weigh all the factors impersonally and just say, what is the appropriate response here? And many people who are nice all the time are not really nice. They're just afraid. And fear and nice is not the same thing. Fear is not an appropriate response, and fear does not move you into the center. So truth is how you serve people with the purest that you can do. But I mean, Swamiji, many times I said, well, sir, I didn't say anything because I was so upset. He said, speak up anyway. Better to speak the truth with a lot of emotion than to not speak it. Because at least if you bring it out, you can start working with it. And you just be as honest as you can. On a scale of 1 to 10, if you're only a 2, still go there. But you know that I'm a 2. You go there as honestly as you can. Oh, I'm really upset, but I'm being quiet is not an option here. Fair? Yeah, it's a very important distinction. Yeah?
A lot of times, though, I have said things so in a real hurtful, abrupt way, like you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So now I like to get back and then go back.
Right. So we try to, we learn from our own experiences, don't we? But you see, if you suppressed, this is the way Swamiji put it, it's better to be over-emotional than it is to be too self-censoring. Because if we're always censoring ourselves and nothing ever comes out, nothing grows. You're not better for having suppressed it all. This is basically everything is stuck.
Does that contradict the karma issue, though?
Well, karma is difficult because karma is not to be nice. Truth and, okay, here's what we're trying to do with karma. We're trying to free ourselves of compulsion. That's the word we're looking for. We want freedom. The unlearned lesson is how to be free and not be limited. And fear is a compulsion. Fear is not freedom. So if you're being silent or not standing up for something that should be stood up for out of fear, you're just perpetuating the karma. Because it could be coming to you, so you don't always know what the lesson is. Sometimes the lesson is just to have the courage to stand up. Even if you fail completely. One of Taylor Caldwell's stories was about in ancient Greece, there was some kind of a thing where they put young girls in front of raging bulls, and the children had to learn to jump over the horns of the bull. And in this particular story, the girl jumped but was gored and killed. But the way the story was told was that the entire karma was the courage to face the bull. And when she faced the bull, it didn't matter if she lived or died, she'd finished her incarnation. I mean, symbolic and beautifully symbolic. You know, it's not the end of the story till the happy ending is there. So with karma, you have to ask yourself, what is binding me here? And for some people, you know, who just love to rage at everyone else and have no problem expressing themselves, it's time to shut up. But for others who let everybody walk all over them and just don't have the courage to utter a peep, then it's time to speak. And it's better to speak in chaos than to be silent any longer. Yeah?
A case in point is a relative, that, a couple of relatives that I had, that she was so passive, mm-hmm. and he was belligerent, became an alcoholic, and I think because there was nothing to butt up against.
Yes, exactly.
He died an alcoholic at 40.
Yeah. Her response was inappropriate.
Exactly.
Yeah. And she was looking good. You know, she was sacrificing herself, but she wasn't serving herself. And you have a relationship with yourself, too. She was neither serving herself nor him.
And in retrospect, I see the weakness and the fear.
Yeah, exactly.
That was there to keep her from, you know, putting the skids on this and saying no.
So your relationship, you have to realize, is also with your own self. And you can choose yourself. Sometimes you are the most important person in the room. You just are. This person is just too selfish for me to think about. I've had to tell mothers that sometimes. One mother was talking to me once, and I said, I wish you could tell me one inspiring story about your children, but I think you've just got this selfish crowd, and I just don't see any value in you're constantly sacrificing yourself for them. And, I mean, that was a hard truth, but I'd known her for a long time, and it was just the truth. I said, you know this, I don't know where you got these people, but whoever they are, you know, enough already.
Well, we help create them.
Well, no, not really. Here's how Swamiji put it. I said this during the break. Swamiji said, you know, the mother and father create the body through which the soul can express its destiny. But the parents create neither the destiny nor the soul. Now, of course, you influence and you have a responsibility, but I'm going to draw this picture. I'll take the eternal now off the board here.
Say that again.
I will say it again. Here goes the eternal now. Okay, the parents create the body through which the soul expresses its destiny, but the parents create neither the soul nor its destiny. Think about it. Of course you don't. Think how many times people have sex and how few times they conceive. I mean, you know, there's more going on. It's not just you guys, right? Somebody else is involved. But think of it also like this. Let's say this is the trajectory of one incarnation. Like, you know, here's you're going, you start, you go through the whole thing, and then you pass away. And, you know, from the same origin point of this soul, you've done this really a lot of times. You've done this a lot of times. You've done this a lot of times, a lot of times, a lot of times. Okay? Reincarnation is essential. In every incarnation, you had parents. Right? You had parents. You had parents. Okay, some people stay with their parents their whole lives, continue to have a relationship. But, you know, many times you separate from your parents and you go on and you do other things and your parents are still your parents, but you know you've taken over your own life. I was a very cheeky child, and I remember at the age of 10, my parents were trying to get me to do something. My mother must, they must have laughed themselves sick after, you know, after they walked away from me when I think about it now. I was a puny little kid, and I remember very vividly, the die is cast, I declared to my parents. The die is cast. I loved big words. I'm either a good kid or a bad kid, and there's nothing you can do about it now. Can you imagine? But here's what's really interesting. I knew it was true. You know, I really did. I wasn't just mouthing off. I absolutely could feel it inside myself. That I was small and they were going to run my life for a while longer, but it really, they did not create my life, and I knew it absolutely. You know, I was a little more conscious than some kids, but, you know, it's the truth. So in just a moment, in all these incarnations, we have parents. You know, we have all these parents. And sometimes, you know, you have the same parents, but look how much is going on. It's not like it means nothing. And it's very important for the parents also. It's big karma for them too. But nobody's destiny is determined. You know, your own is. Your own consciousness is. But you don't own these children. You just move them around. You know, while they're little, you can actually move them around. And then they just turn into us. I mean, Raghu, stand up and show them how big you are. You know, like, right? I mean, I mean, imagine the point. Yeah. Imagine the point at which his, you know, mother realizes, you know, she can't move him. She can speak to him, but
But when I'm thinking about creation, I'm thinking about when you have two personalities come together as a couple or whatever relationship, by not standing up there for yourself, you're helping create this personality.
Exactly.
I wasn't talking about the actual
form
of creation.
You influence. But you know, we can all look at our own lives and our own parents, and we can gauge how much influence they have. And it's something. And it depends. Our mother influences us more than our father more than our mother, our siblings, our aunt, our grandmother. You know, we're influenced. But think about it, really. And it's very important. I mean, I'm always so amazed, all due respect, never having even been pregnant myself, but I'm always amazed by the inflated importance that parents give themselves, even when the evidence in their own life is that their parents did not have that role in their life. You know, just the inability just even to see. But the main thing is, if you're thinking of service, if you're thinking about being part of a greater reality, of Divine Mother being in charge, of karma being fair, and consciousness being everything, you do your darndest to carry it out correctly. Because if you don't, you're just going to reap the consequences. So why would you be crummy at it? As Swamiji said, you don't get out of karma by doing it badly. So you just do as best you can. But if, now my circle is gone, you know, if you're acting more from the center and less from the side, the chances of you achieving your own goals are better, of actually serving the person. You're going to be much better at serving them if you know who you're working with. Okay, Lindy, you had a...
Well, I just wish my parents would say, you know, at some point I think most kids say, I didn't ask to be born. And my kids say that, I'm going to say, oh, yes,
you
did.
Let me tell you. Let me tell the rest of that. There's a man in our community, Bajran, and he had no children of his own. Our community meaning Ananda Village. But he was a school teacher, and he really liked kids, and he just did this whole ministry for years, still does, with many of the children. If you look up Team Sprite, of all things, on the internet, he and a whole bunch of kids rebuilt a little car, and then he sold it. I mean, there's lots. He did great things with the children. So now, because in our community, all the parents are armed with that. So the kids become rebellious. I don't like what you're doing. You know, I don't know why you're behaving like this. You're a terrible mother. Every child says that sometime or another. And so then the mothers get to say back to the father, it's not my fault. You chose me. So the kids went to him and said, I never chose them, you know. I never would have chosen them. So he goes to Swami Kriyananda. What do I say, you know? Because they, first of all, he had to stay aligned with the parents. He couldn't be, you know, opposite their own parents. And philosophically, it was true, but how do you really answer them? So Swami's answer was actually interesting. He said, yes, everything is interwoven. I mean, you know, there's the rug. Well, this isn't actually woven. But when you put threads together, you know, they're all interwoven and they go like in far ways. So you never end up with one picture without it all converging. But Swamiji said you don't actually literally select every piece of it. He said you go with flows of energy. And often in a family, you won't be that deeply connected. The thread right next to you might not necessarily be your mother or your father. Or it might be only your mother and not your father. It might be your sibling. It might even be, well, how can I put this? Sometimes a person who intends to live a spiritual life does not want to be that closely connected to their physical family because they want to be able to travel lightly through this world and go on to their spiritual life. So they will, to use Swami's phrase, choose a body that is good enough, or even choose a body that just, you know, the karma is light. Or there'll be one person, you'll be very deeply attached to your mother, and then all your siblings and the rest of the story will just come in with her. But in order to be with her, that's where you had to be. You see? And then it's like your circles coincide. This is your mother, that let's say, and this is you. And you intersect like that, but then she's got this whole arc over here that's all that she chose, that she's bringing in with her. And you have all this that's really going to be your life on this side, that, and you only intersect like that, you see. So, yes, they did choose you. And yes, you can put it all back on them, and it is their fault. One little girl, let me just say this, one little boy, he was really mad at his mom. He was sick. This was the woman who wasn't on the spiritual path, and only later did she tell me this story because I said these things. Her son was mad at her, 5 years old. "You're a terrible mother. I hate you." Happens. He stomps out of the room, and then this is not enough. He goes back, and he said, "You weren't even my first choice." And she was so fascinated. She said, "Really, darling, who was?" And he answered her, "A lady in the Philippines, but she was taken." Yeah, so the reason she told me this, because I told her what Master said. Master said, when the sperm and ovum come together, there is a spark of light in the astral world. I'm quoting. I mean, I don't know these things from my own experience. And it has a certain vibration, and all the souls that are ready to be born who are in tune with that light rush to get in. And sometimes two or three will get in at the same time. And I told her this, and my friend laughed. She said, "I can just see him," because she said, "He has this quality of he wants to go for something and then he hesitates." She said she could just see him in the astral world heading for that woman in the Philippines, but then stopping for a minute thinking about it.
Out of my way.
Yeah, when some are like that, out of my way. Yeah, exactly. She's mine.
So what if you never had a connection with anybody in your family, even if you grew up in the family? Uh-huh. Like, no connection or bond with mother, sisters?
This can either be...
Could it possibly have been to experience what I was supposed to learn?
Of course it was. Their karma is always fair. Uh-huh. And it's always about unlearned lessons. It could be, you can only answer that yourself. Okay? It could be because you didn't appreciate a good family when you had one. Now, that might be a story that people know. You had good families before and you didn't appreciate them. So now you don't have the magnetism to get a really good family. You're going to have to experience what it is. You're going to have to learn to be grateful. And the way, if you're not grateful for what comes to you, you don't get any more, do you? You give somebody a nice present and they say, "Oh, I didn't like this. It's not what I wanted." You're not going to give them another present later. So you lose your prosperity if you're not grateful. That could be the reason. You could also have maybe you had a family that was so on top of you, you just said, "Never again. Just never again. I'm just going to get a body where I can, and I'm just going to make sure those people don't hang around me."
So would it... That was my situation. Mm-hmm. And so I was just not connected to any of them in any way. Mm-hmm. And so there was so much negativity and so much chaos that I decided to move away mm-hmm. from it all and to keep a distance, and maybe... Now it's just a phone call every once in a while, and that's as far as I allow it to touch me. Mm-hmm. So is that not appreciated?
No, it could easily be the appropriate response. And maybe in previous lifetimes you didn't have the nerve to respond appropriately. Mm-hmm. Maybe you let them own you, mm-hmm. and you were just swallowed up by them. You didn't have the self-esteem to just say, "I'm sorry, I'm not interested." Mm-hmm. So it all has to be... Yes, it all has to be balanced out according to what's appropriate. What am I learning here? If people are negative and unhelpful, why expose yourself to it? You got to have the nerve to say, "Done." Yeah. No, it's very freedom. You see, freedom is the key here.
So, what can I do to have a better family next?
Meditate. Be a better family.
Be good to others.
Yes.
My own.
Create the magnetism, that whatever magnetism you want to experience, manifest it. It's just as simple as that. You radiate what you are. And what radio signals am I sending out? and appropriate, this behavior is not appropriate. I'm not going to accept that from you. If I hate you because you treated me this way, ooh, that's not such a good response. But just a, well, that's your reality. It's not mine. Mm-hmm. End of story. That's a nice wave to send out. Mm. But freedom, always freedom. Freedom from compulsion. I married in this lifetime. I lived for a time as a renunciate. Then I have a wonderful husband. It's been a wonderful life together. I'd be very happy to live with him many times again. But I married him out of compulsion. I married him because he was so adorable. I just really wanted to live with him. It was just as simple as that. And, gee, I could do worse than that, you know, because he is a wonderful man. But I would have liked to have been more centered. I would like to have been more calmly asking God's will instead of announcing to God what was about to happen. You know, that would have been nicer. But I would be perfectly happy to live with him many more lifetimes. But I would like to be a little freer in my heart than I was when I started with him. You know, it's freedom. I would like to be completely surrendered to God's will and not have as many likes and dislikes. And I trust God will do the right thing by me. And, I mean, this marriage has been wonderful, and I don't think either he or I could have done many of the things that we've done, that we did together. I mean, it's been a great partnership. It's not past by any means. But I would have liked to have been a little more centered in myself at the start. Yeah. Sure.
Surrendering completely to God's will.
Mm. Big story.
It's a big one. Yes. Mm. And so I ask daily when I pray, allow me to surrender to your will rather than mine, because mm-hmm. I will mess it up.
That's a good beginning. Yeah. Yes. leave me on my own, and this is what you're going to get. It's not pretty. Okay.
So when I surrender in those few moments, maybe even that day, what do I look for? So I talk to God throughout the day, all the time. He's like my best friend. Uh-huh. You know, I'm constantly in conversation with God. And so surrendering to his will, do I wait for...
No, you're not passive. Surrendering to his will is doing the best you can with whatever's in front of you. I mean, just the best you can with whatever's in front of you. And the infallible sign of God's presence is joy. And it's just because you do enjoy it doesn't mean that he doesn't want you to enjoy it. Swami, that's scrupulosity in the Catholic Church. The more you suffer, the more holy you are. Swamiji, I mean, we fall into that. I fell into that. Swami looked at me and said, God does not want you to be unhappy. He said, that's your idea, not the divine. So joy is what you should do. And just find the joy, whatever it is. And use your common sense. It's really not as complicated as you think. It's just a question of just going along and trying to, in every situation, not complain, rise with good energy, try to serve, and you'll find that it flows. Yeah. I can go on, and I'm quite happy to, but I also have I'm a great respecter of time, and I believe we have actually hit the announced limit of our experience here, so I would like to allow you all to exit if you want to or need to. And I'm also perfectly happy to stay and talk to as many of you as may want to, so I'll do both. Okay? And I'm giving a class tonight at the Meditation Center. I'll be here tomorrow morning for Sunday service, and then we're bipping over to Lakewood. I don't know where we're going. Somebody will put me in a car, and we're going somewhere else. So there's three more programs before I go back to California. We're not going out to lunch, and everyone is welcome. So,
I had a question. I think I've been doing.
Let me give
wrong.
Pause, and feel you won't be rude if you walk out at this point. Okay. Yeah.
Question. I think I've been doing it all wrong because sometimes I feel like, well, I've heard that you reincarnate with groups.
Uh huh.
So these people that you're around daily or whatever, you're going to have to come back and see again.
Not necessarily. No. The end. You can learn if you learn the lesson, you won't have to see them again. If they haven't learned the lesson, they still have to learn it, but you don't have to learn it with you. They get to learn it from someone else.
If you feel that negative, you don't have to be around them.
You don't, yeah, you can finish it all
by
yourself.
You don't have to be nice to them.
No, you don't have to be nice. Just what, your name again? Evie was asking. You know, no, you just have to behave appropriately. And if they're just not behaving appropriately and nothing you do is going to teach them, you can't hasten their evolution, but you can extricate yourself from it. Swami was very explicit with me on that. He said, if you learn the lesson, he'll learn it with someone else. You know, you just learn it for yourself. Otherwise, my God, no one would ever get anywhere. You'd all just be stuck. You'd be the lowest common denominator would hold everybody down. Yeah.
So the lesson, let's say someone was incredibly and brutally just mean to you all of your life. So learning that lesson, what is learning the lesson? How do I know? How am I sure that I've learned the lesson? I've already separated
common
myself.
Sense was the word you used. Mm-hmm. If you're still afraid of it, that means there's still karma. Swamiji said, when I asked him, I actually asked him a different question, and this is the answer he gave me, that if fear and longing are the two things that bind you, so if you long for something or if you fear it, and if you fear it, it doesn't mean that you have to go back and stand in front of the powerful person who beat you up. It just means you have to keep working in your heart to be unafraid of it. But Master said, if you know you're going to be defeated, then he said, run away.
Yeah. And so if you feel peace with the separation and the distance.
Or even if you feel no peace with it, but you know if you go back into it, you're just going to lose again, you just stay away.
So you've learned the lesson.
Yeah, well, no. The lesson may at this point be to recognize my limits. To not be so egotistical as to imagine that I can face that and succeed at it. I think somebody here is responding, amen, over on this side. Yeah. I just like, you know, this negativity is so much bigger than my capacity to face it. You know, my lesson right now is to hide from this negativity. And that's...
Get over the ego that says, I can...
That's exactly right. Ego that says, I can do it.
If you haven't completed lessons with that person, they'll come up with...
Don't worry. Don't worry. You'll get to learn it. The way Swami put it to me once, you've gone as far as you can go right now. He said, you need to go off and grow in another way. And when you're big enough, this will come back to you. Don't worry. You'll get to do it. But you'll get to do it in a way that you can win. Master said, really, if you're going to be defeated, I love this, run away. Because he said it doesn't serve you to be defeated over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Elaborate on the longing part of it.
And the longing part of it is, oh, if only I could have married George instead of marrying Henry, then my life would have been so beautiful.
Why are you talking about me?
You know, Henry turned out to be such a jerk and George was such a hero. But when he loved me, I didn't. You know, that's longing. Or, you know,
and
gosh.
Bad about that?
Well, nothing's bad about that. It's just that you get to do it. And you get to find out how happy George is going to make you. And here's the important point about this. We learn from being disappointed, but we learn more from being fulfilled. Because as long as we don't get it, we imagine that there's a happiness there that has been denied to me. So what we really learn from is having those desires fulfilled. And then you realize, that was wonderful. But you know, there's something still in my heart. And then that's when we begin to turn to God. And we don't turn to God. That's why poverty-stricken people who are trying to find enough food to eat and trying to break into material comfort rarely, I would say never, come to the teaching of self-realization. Because they imagine that all that will make them happy. And when we say, no, it won't, they say, oh, come on, that's easy for you to say. That's why in all our temples you see, relatively speaking, well-to-do, fairly successful people, because we have drunk those cups to the bottom and said, that was good, but gosh, isn't there anything more? You know, my own life is very interesting in that respect. I've had just a wonderful life. I've had very, very, very little trauma. And I said to Swami, I'm just obsessive about being happy. He said, past lives, you know, been there, done that. I realize I've had so many things I know in past lives. I know they're not going to make me happy now. So now I'm just trying to stay on the main event. So a lot of those longings have to be fulfilled. So don't be afraid of your karma. You want to be a movie star? Go out and be a movie star. You know, you want to marry and have children? Go out and marry and have children. Because if you really want to, you're not going to. No, you can't have somebody say, it's not really going to make you happy, dear. Easy for you to say. You're married to George, you know. But then go through it as consciously as you can. What is this giving me? You know, that's why I speak of my life with my husband. I really wanted to marry him. And I did, and we've had a wonderful life together. It's been marvelous. Nothing is wrong with it at all. It's not like I'd say, oh, I want to repudiate marriage. And no, not at all. But I was not very centered at the beginning. That's what I'd like to be. I'd like to be centered. Yeah, there's lots of things we long for. When Swami told that to me, I said, well, sir, my first 10 years at Ananda Village through my 20s when we were building the community from the mud, it was so much fun. I said, I'd go back to it like that. He said, that's different. That's just enthusiasm and gratitude. That's not really like, oh, I really long for this. But longing can also be, you know, I really made a terrible mistake. I mistreated that person. I should have. It's regret. Longing and regret, excuse me. Longing and regret. Fear, longing, regret. Now, I want to be fair. I don't think he used the word fear. He said longing and regret. Excuse me, I misquoted that. He said longing and regret. I put in the word fear because regret is often fear. You know, they're tied together. You regret something, there's an anxiety about it. Longing and regret is what draws you back. So if you've done the wrong thing, if you didn't do it properly, you need to overcome even that. Realize God was in charge. It seemed like a good idea at the time. That's what I say to myself. Oh, it seemed like a good idea at the time. My other phrase is, I did the best I could with the understanding I had.
So we regret as well, let it go, because you can't fix.
No. But if you do deeply regret, your ego is still really tied to it. And you have to go back and face it. That's not, you know, that's the karma. You do have to go back and face it and do it right. Eric.
Do you create the situation that you have to do right again?
You
or
imagine
does it naturally come back to you?
Karma is carried from life to lifetime by the pattern of energy in the chakras. The chakras are the energy centers in the spine. They are not physical. The physical body is built around it. You know, the movies are great now. The person dies and the little astral body comes out. It's the same actor, except that now he can walk through the walls. You know, he's the same guy. That's actually very true. But what comes out is the energy pattern imprinted on the chakras that caused you to manifest this particular physical body. This particular body falls off exactly as if you take your coat off and you're still there. And it goes, and in the astral world, the vibrations of energy, and this is a very short lesson of a very long subject, every action, every attitude, everything you do in your whole life has a vibration on the spectrum of consciousness between absolute affirmation of the material world and your selfish interest to the level of a Christ consciousness. And everything you do falls somewhere on that spectrum. That spectrum is reflected in your chakras. So every time you do anything, the energy of what you've done becomes a vibration of energy in the chakras. Now, this is not physical, so there's no space limitations here. And at the end of it, you have a certain magnetism, don't you? And that's the aura that people read. You know, everybody has magnetism. You can feel it. And what they're just walking around. It's metaphysics. There's nothing mysterious about it. When your physical body dies, that energy pattern is really what defines you. Your physical body was quite incidental, literally, like your clothes. So that energy pattern goes on, and it hangs out in the astral world. And when the karma of longing and regret make it time for you to need to take another physical body because you need to go through this again, that energy pattern finds another appropriate energy pattern, and you find yourself in a body, and all that energy is radiating, just like this. So then all the other souls, either the other jivas that you're specifically going to meet again, they all start moving like this. It's an energy universe. everything is interconnected. So you're just sitting there vibrating like that. Like that. And you're magnetizing.
The other jivas.
Exactly.
That was kind of the answer to my question. I was actually thinking if you want to develop courage, you don't exactly have to go out and find a war to walk into.
Well, sometimes you do.
Sometimes you do. That's
no, that's exactly right. Yeah, that's where your karma comes from. You are drawn to do that which you need to do in order to fulfill the karma, the unfinished karma within you.
So you could put yourself in a circumstance.
Why do you think then?
Clearly saw would challenge you in a way to rise above that.
That's why, you know, people need to be soldiers. Sometimes to be a soldier is going up. Sometimes for someone else to be a soldier is going down. But for someone else to be a soldier could be going up. Could be a very, very important self-sacrificing, self-discipline experience. So that's when you stop judging. You really do stop judging because you realize, wow, look what they're... It's fascinating. You think, wow, that's tough karma. But still, that's why it's always fair. Yeah.
Similar to the question about children, soldiers with their PTSD, how do you wrap your brain around what happens to them when they can't escape that?
Well, they're caught in the subconscious, aren't they? Yeah, I mean, it's imprinted itself, you know, it's imprinted itself so deeply. The way to deal with all of that is think of it like this. If you have a white expanse here and there's a dark black spot, if you stand here, everything is black. So the only way to really deal with that is to just back up from it and get a bigger perspective. I am part of a greater reality. I have a loving divine mother who's giving me the experiences I need. All karma is fair. What am I supposed to be learning here? And that's tough karma. But it's always fair.
So just back away from...
And just, I mean, serve them in any way you can. But if they can't let go of it, you just have to figure out what your appropriate response is. How much can I help?
And you're helping them to back away from it.
Well, you try to expand their perspective. Actually, we had a group of wounded warriors come to our community once. They had a retreat at our expanding light, and it turned out to be a tremendously positive environment for them, because you know the perspective that we had collectively. You know, we had compassion, but we weren't freaked out. You know, because you're living in this bigger picture. Yeah, that's tough karma. There's no question about that. But there was a relaxation about our ability to relate to it. Yeah. Yes.
So just listening to everything you're saying about, you know, we are souls, you know, hanging out in the astral world, and then we find a body to work on our own journey and all that.
Yeah.
Because... we're part of a very big family, and how do I help my mother? How can I help her to not take personal responsibility for everybody's choices? You know what I'm saying?
I don't really.
You know, we're all. You know, she says it all the time. You know, we're all here, and we're all this family. But everybody has their own vibration, their own energy, their own choices, and she takes personal responsibility by having fashioned everybody. And I want to be kind. But she gets so sucked into everybody's choices because she feels as if she has a responsibility. And I'm thinking, Mom, we're grown. Well, you're not responsible anymore.
Okay, if you're standing here, and if your mother's standing here, and that's where you want her to go, okay, I think to get to there, she's got to go to here first. Mm-hmm. So often we ask people to take steps they can't take.
Mm. So what's the kindest way for me to give myself permission to stop taking responsibility?
I doubt if she even wants to stop taking responsibility. It's her self-definition. She's done it her whole life. She mothered all these kids. What would she do if she didn't worry about her kids all the time? I would say this is sympathetic clucking noises. Wow. You know, you can... No, sympathetic, you know, she wants to be loved and she wants to be felt that she's a good mother. Yeah,
give her permission.
I had the funniest experience. Yeah. No, give her permission. She wants to suffer. sympathetic clucking noises. You don't have to argue with her. It took me years to figure out. You know, just... I used to think I always had to articulate something because I could. It made people so mad. I was always telling them things they didn't want to know. So I just started going, and I found out almost nothing was required. They just wanted to feel that you love them. I would hear Swami. Swami would go, yeah. Just like that. I began to notice that. He committed himself to nothing. Oh. In India, they go, acha, like that. So I was asked to define, he said, the definition of this is, I exist, you exist. No, you'll find, and your mom will love you for it. Well, I was raised Jewish. My mother never was into Ananda at all, but she would follow various things. And when we had the oratorio, we wrote the oratorio, and it was all about Christ. My mother decided we had become Christians. She decided Ananda had become Christians. I tried to reason this out with her for a while. And when she was really, and then she started in one day, mostly we had a harmonious relationship. It's just every so often they would flip into these things. My mother started saying, if only we had raised you in the Jewish faith, this wouldn't have happened. And I was trying to comfort her, and this little voice inside of me said, let her take responsibility. And I said, yes, Mom, who knows what might have happened if I'd been raised differently. And I just gave her the responsibility. She accepted it, and the subject never came up again. As long as I was arguing with her, it just went on and on. I said, she wants to be responsible. Just let her. Just let her do it. And it was, you know, I went with her. I was serving her much more by being a loving support for her reality than by contradicting it. Wow. Contradicting it infuriated her.
Interesting. Start clucking so I get help.
Oh. Yeah. Along that line, in relationships, and you had said not to be, you know, passive. But if not being passive has never worked out, then maybe the appropriate response sometime is not to be passive, but just to let, in other words, I have a relationship with a sibling that I'm never going to win. And so I want it to be harmonious. I think that brings me more joy. So I've learned to, the appropriate response is to not respond.
Exactly.
Okay.
As long as you're not doing it because you're afraid to respond. It's just not worth it to you.
Yeah.
You just look at it and you just think, I'm going to weigh my bad alternatives here.
Yeah.
And I think silence is better because...
That's okay, too.
Yeah, of course, because they're not going to learn anything when I argue with them. Mm-hmm. It's going to exhaust me and teach them nothing.
There you go. Right.
And so what is the point?
Yeah.
And so there was this woman that I had to work with who was just so overbearing. And I said to Swamiji, you know, she's just so impossible. Swami said, oh, I just don't bother to have a personality when she's in the room. He said, she has enough personality for everyone in the room. He said, so I just don't have one when I'm with her. It's just like, why? She wants to assert herself on every issue, so I'll go along with her. What difference does it make? I have nothing to prove. I'm comfortable in myself. And that one works really well. If you can, and see, there's nothing wrong with that. I don't have to have a personality all the time. When it's my turn, I'll have one.
Can you do that with yourself?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel like I've got this personality that I did something in the past and I want to make it different. Mm-hmm. So I imagine other scenarios like I did really well and I'll try to change the past. And it really never changes the past. I just keep obsessing on it. So I've learned to kind of really step away from trying to correct the past in a sense. But the only way I can do it is to almost be personalityless, thoughtless.
Well, what you do is you disidentify, if there is such a word, you disidentify with your own ego. And you realize that my ego did those things, but that didn't mean I did them.
I tell you, thinking that line of thinking rarely helps me, unfortunately. The only thing that really helps me is meditation or silence or something.
But
it's
meditation,
hard for me to think things out.
Well, but meditation or silence is the same thing, because instead of standing here, you've taken yourself into a bigger reality. Here's what I want to add to that.
I'm interacting with it in one sense, but not interacting with in this other sense.
I don't know if this is directly relevant, so you tell me. But this woman faced a very traumatic event. Someone treated her very wrongly. And she was trying to get over the hurt, so she said to Swamiji, everything that happened was just the way it had to happen. He said, no, it wasn't. He behaved very badly, just like that. He shouldn't have done that. That was wrong action on his part. He said, don't try to make yourself better by trying to avoid the truth.
That's very good.
So he said, what you have to do is you have to look right at it, see exactly what happened, see where responsibility is. Then you have to say karma is always fair. And you have to step back and saying, but we're all souls on a journey, including me. And this was not our shining hour, but it was just part of the story. You see how different that is? Yeah.
So in this scenario, is the word impersonal with ourselves and others, does that apply?
Impersonal is a really great word. I used to loathe that word, but I really like it now. Master said, we make a mistake to think that everything that happens to us concerns us personally, which I found just, he might have well been speaking Swahili for all I could understand. But now I really get it. Impersonal means that I see it, it happened, but I don't have to own every aspect of it. It was just, even my own ego and my own karmic events are happening here. And from here, you know, I'm connected to it, but I'm not defined by it. That the word is defined by it. Oh, yeah, at that point in my life, that was where I was, and that's what I did, and that's what happened. But I'm at a different point in my life, and I've had lots of points in my life, and, you know, you see it a little more impersonally.
I choose to see that as being non-feeling.
No, that's what's wrong. It has nothing to do with feeling. In fact, Swamiji said, because he's so impersonal, speaking of himself, he can be much more wholehearted in his commitment and his relationships to people. Because he is not afraid. He has nothing to lose. So it's the opposite of being unfeeling. It's you have nothing to lose. Give life your heart. Bless everything that's grown. Fear not the loving. All this world's our own. That's a verse from a song. I think we're done. Okay. It's been really fun. Thank you all so much. Great.
Thank you.